Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello.
Hello. Hello.
Hello. Hello. How are you feeling?
Had a headache today.
Sarah had a headache.
I don't get a lot of headaches.
You get them every now and again. And it becomes not just a problem for you, but it becomes a bone of contention for us.
I said, oh, I have a bad headache. You went, take some paracetamol. And I went, well, let me just drink a glass of water. And I heard deep exasperation.
Yes, it's exasperating.
You are a headache person. So you're getting headaches multiple times in a week. And I would say that the second you get a headache, you take two paracetamol and codeine. I have a headache. I'm going to get a pint glass, fill it with water, eat something, and see how I go across the hour. This is incredibly annoying to you.
Yes, because why wouldn't you take the painkiller and have a glass of water and then eat something? Because if you don't do that and the water and the food don't make it go away, then you've got to take the paracetamol and you've had a headache for an hour instead of for half an hour.
Because none of these things are that bad. Now, as it happened, I drank a glass of water and like ate a slice of toast and it wasn't shifting. And then I thought, I probably do need the painkillers, but I was too fucking annoyed at you to say, where are the painkillers? Because you've got like a stash of paracetamol and codeine, and there was no way for me to secretly take them.
I'm like a dragon sitting atop a pile of treasure.
I felt like you were sniffing around, waiting to see if I went to any of your stashes to prove your fucking point that I needed the painkillers in the first place.
But aren't you just describing a marriage there? We're all just waiting for the opportunity. Not to say I told you so, but to give a look that says as much.
Exactly. But as it happened on this occasion, I did need the painkiller. But sometimes... Yeah. A bit of water and food solves my problem.
Does it?
Yes, it does. Why is that a problem for you if I'm not complaining?
Because you might not be complaining, but you're moving around like somebody with a headache.
No, I'm not. That's not even true. You had annoyed me, and that was my issue.
I just think some paracetamol and codeine would have numbed you to that emotion of irritation about me.
How healthy.
Fine.
Yeah.
Well, I want to say to you, listen to this, welcome to the podcast. If you have that slight feeling, you know, when you go out for dinner with a couple and before they've even brought the bread, that couple are bickering and you're thinking, we might be in for an evening of it here. Don't worry, we're going to shift it. We're going to shift the energy now. We're going to shift the energy. And I'm going to tell you about this week's guest. Now, last week, we were raving about the jury murder trial on Channel 4, which has been one of these shows that everyone is talking about. It's sort of show that if you worked in an office with a water cooler... then you could go and get yourself a cup of water and then go back to your desk and think about it quietly. It's really a very good show. If you've seen it, no doubt you will have a gajillion questions about how they made it. So Sarah worked her magic. She slid into the DMs of the executive producer of the jury murder trial. He's also creative director of Screen Dog, the company behind it. He is Ed Kelly.
And we had the privilege of speaking to him in person. I was so unprepared for how tall he was. And I worked really hard to not be like, Ed, you're so tall. I mean, I was dazzled. I don't even know what to say.
Yeah, well, I hope the two of you will be very happy together.
Oh my God. And if you think that the marriage might end, like, I'm looking for a second husband.
Our guest later is executive producer of the jury murder trial on Channel 4, Ed Kelly. Quick watch.
My quick watch this week, I took one of your recommendations. I watched the Beauty and the Bloodshed, which is a documentary. It was pitched to me as being about the opioid crisis, which you know will hook me in. I disagree slightly with that. I think really what it's about is this artist and photographer, Nan Golden. We see her in the 70s kind of come up as this underground photographer. And then that is juxtaposed against her in the present day having suffered a OxyContin addiction and becoming this activist who's trying to bring the Sacklers down.
So is it fun being in that New York art world in the 70s and 80s as you get to know her backstory?
Ooh. So we see her in this community of artists. I lived in New York for a long time and I knew a lot of aspiring artists. And I would say none of us were particularly talented. Some of us were like gobsmackingly untalented. But then you look at like documentary footage of someone doing a reading at a happening in the 70s and you'll be like, I think that's pretty well written, actually. Whereas if I went to a happening in 2006, it would be insane. It would be very, very bad.
Hang on, you were going to happenings?
I went to a couple of happenings.
Is this when you were in your beat poet phase? What was it? Spoken word poetry?
I did some spoken word poetry.
Didn't you perform live in Harlem?
I did perform. So it was like 20 years ago. I performed spoken word poetry while wearing a fedora. I'd be like, well, I'm doing my poetry now, so I guess I got to put on the fedora. I can't even open my eyes. I'm in a state of such profound shame.
And what was the subject matter of the poem?
I don't know if I could talk about this.
You can.
I think like there was something about like not having a thigh gap.
Okay.
So like it was very like I'm different. Oh, like I'm different to the other girls from my suburbs. Jeff, I can't tell you.
We want to hear it.
I don't know if I can do this.
You can do it. Come on.
The thigh gap line was like, it was something about like I'm going like this.
Can you describe what like this is?
I'm like moving my hand in the way I think a spoken word poet should move their hand. It was essentially like, so now I understand that I'm a very medium level woman. But 20 years ago, when it was still very acceptable to talk about how disgusting we all are if we're not a size like 6, I was trying to be like, can you handle
a size 8 woman?
A full size lady. So I think that was the a little of what was going on.
Yeah.
Jeff,
different times.
It was like, I can't do it.
You can do it. You can. I'm here to encourage you. We're all rooting for Sarah, the spoken word poet in the fedora. Come on, that line is in there.
It's like the same. I'm just going to say, if you can't handle, it would be like something like, and if you cannot handle it. So like that was the energy. Mm-hmm. And then the line that I remember, It was about like these same two thighs.
These same two thighs.
That touch up top. That's all touch I remember.
Okay.
Like, can you handle, like, so in other words, it's like something about like, can you handle a woman with thighs?
Can I ask you a question? Have you still got the fedora?
No. My parents came to see me once I got to go to Connecticut and performed in Black History Month.
What? What kind of cultural misappropriation is this? I'm not blaming you for this. I'm blaming the organizers of a Black History Month event that considered booking you and your spoken word poems.
I know.
Those people deserve to be cancelled.
Okay, and I just want to apologize.
To the Black community.
I don't think it was.
Or to everyone.
To everyone. Everyone. All I remember is that Whitney Houston's mom was the host. And I remember my parents came from Chicago because it was like a big theater. And I remember Whitney Houston's mom going, Sarah Baron, like when I was done, remember that name. And my mom saying, oh, Whitney Houston's mom said to remember your name.
All right. So to bring us back to all the beauty and the bloodshed, Nan Goldin, did you like her?
No.
Oh. But you think she's brilliant?
Yeah, I mean, I think she's a genius.
And did you enjoy the documentary?
Medium, I would say.
All right, my quick watch this week, The Completely Made-Up Adventures of Dick Turpin on Apple TV Plus. Now, the reason I watch this is I'm always looking for something to watch with our son. And he loves Dick Turpin, the Highwayman, because of Horrible Histories. And I like Dick Turpin because I enjoyed Adamant Standard Deliver when I was a kid. And also there used to be a Dick Turpin on ITV when I was little with Richard O'Sullivan, who the name will mean nothing to you. He was in a lot of British sitcoms in the 70s. And I Googled him because I thought he was dead. And he is still alive. And he lives in a retirement home funded by the big entertainment charity, the Royal Variety Club. And I'd heard about this place. There is an old person's home in which these old show business legends reside together. So at one stage, these names will mean nothing to you, but they will to British listeners of a certain age. At one stage, Alan Fluff Freeman, Thora Heard, Mick McManus, the wrestler, Hilda Baker, and the man who played Captain Birdseye were all living together in a retirement home. And I'm thinking, why is that not a documentary?
Yeah. Where is the home?
Outskirts of London, I think, or home counties. Back to the present day, the new Dick Turpin, he's played by Noel Fielding of the Mighty Boosh.
Can I tell you about my backstory with the Mighty Boosh? I knew a guy in my neighborhood, and okay. he was really, really, really gorgeous. And I never understood his intentions with me, but I think he liked the idea of like a spunky lady friend. But it got to a stage where I realized he was very dumb. Like when I was like, oh, if you're not gonna involve yourself with me sexually, then why am I here? So then I stopped responding to his texts. And to hook me, he was like, hey, why don't I come over tonight? And like, we'll watch the Mighty Boosh. So it was his way of trying to prove to me that he was an intellectual, was by being like, hey, there's this kind of like cult British thing that I'm really into. And I was like, if you're not taking those pants off, you're not coming to my home, buddy. Like, no.
Aside from finding Noel Fielding funny, here's something I really admire about him. Mm. He found his look and he stuck with it. Like Robert Smith from The Cure or Bono to some extent. Also in this show, Hugh Bonneville, Ellie White, who is really funny. She's the comedy partner of Natasha Dimitriou, who people will know from loads of stuff, including What We Do in the Shadows. And I think this is a very much a family show. Confusingly, there are a few profanities in it. So our son gets very angry if he hears a profanity. If he hears somebody say, what the hell, he becomes livid. So there's a shit and a piss in episode one, and there's a couple of pricks in episode two. And I can feel him bristle. So I don't know what to do about this, because I'm with you. I think that stuff sounds horrible in a kid's mouth, apart from on a viral video in which it can be very funny from time to time.
I never like it.
Sometimes.
It makes me feel disgusted.
Sometimes. But I'm somebody who never in my life said a swear word in front of my mom.
Interestingly, your mother would speak very, very openly about diarrhea. Because that was a medical issue.
Oh, she would. She had no problem talking about any bodily function.
So it was really impressed upon me that I must never, ever swear around her. And then one morning we were at their house and I came downstairs and she was going into very great detail about the diarrhea that she'd had the night before.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, so that's, and I wasn't annoyed, but I was like, genuinely, non-rhetorically was like, wait, so why is like a detailed description of diarrhea completely acceptable? And it was because it was a medical thing she was going through.
It's the profanities she doesn't like, but not the subject matter.
Yes, but a fart isn't a profanity.
No. I think it was just the word fart. You could talk about breaking wind or passing flatus. Anyway, so what I want to say about the completely made up adventures of Dick Turpin is I really enjoyed watching it with our son. I found it genuinely funny. I laughed authentically on a number of occasions. I don't think I would say watch it without the family. I don't think. But it isn't a kids show either. If you want to watch something with your kids where you're not just suffering through it and humouring them, then this is that thing. Well, we'd love to hear from you. Some things you might want to email us about relating to what we talked about so far. Who is the least appropriate performer at Black History Month that you've ever seen? Also, have you ever seen a good stage performance by a suburban white girl involving a fedora?
So I'm just on a journey of finding myself.
We all are. Also, I wondered about this Nan Goldin. Big personalities in documentaries. So we were talking about that thing, Murder on a Sunday Morning, the other week, and you didn't get time to talk about the defense lawyer in that, who just seemed like the documentary maker had unearth this character who was built for the screen.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, who are the people in documentaries that you've seen like that? Also, what is the greatest documentary never made in your opinion? I said earlier that I think it could be about the show business retirement home.
That's good.
But are there others? Also, we could do people who found their luck and stuck with it, like Noel Fielding. And what's up with Anglophiles?
So annoying.
Because I like it when they latch onto things like Doctor Who or the Mighty Boosh, but also things like Keeping Up Appearances with Hyacinth Bouquet seem to attract a strange following in other countries. And of course, your recommendations, please.
Fuck off at firecrotchandnormcore.com. Patreon. Is it time now? Is it time? Do you want to do Patreon push in the style of, and you give me a style like we did last week?
Sure. How about spoken word poem?
That's not funny. I'm not going to do that. Okay, look, first of all, I still haven't gotten my nails done because I haven't had the time. I'm working, Mom. But I really need to, please, guys, please. This is what's going to happen for me this week, if I can. Pedicure, manicure, roots, Botox. I'm seeing a new Botox person, if you want to know. I think it's important to be open. Jeff's really nervous about it. Basically, I saw this Botox woman a few times across a year and a half, but her price had gone up so astronomically. I've got to find a new place. And then I know that we support our bodies in all shapes and sizes, but by Edinburgh, I've got to be looking so tight, because if my show isn't good, then I need to at least have people say, like, Sarah Baron looks good. Like, that is a hot 45.
If you go to Sarah's work in progress in Islington this coming Sunday and you want to talk to her afterwards, that's the only thing you want to hear from people, right?
No. Don't talk to me about my appearance. And don't give me joke suggestions unless you're not an idiot. But the point is, why don't you also come to my show on the 17th? I know so many of you have bought tickets. I'm so, so flattered. Please, 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 if you've been delaying, please, please do it now. It's at the Bill Murray. It's in Islington. It's 4 to 5 p.m. You can be home on the sofa by 6.
I am very worried about you visiting this back street Botox practitioner.
It's not back street. It's just not genuinely like one of the fanciest ladies in London. I'm only going to go once. You can't fuck your face up too much once with Botox. I don't think.
Cut two.
I know. Anyway, I just want to be beautiful.
You are beautiful.
I just want to feel fuckable to someone other than you. Like, I'll only fuck you, but I want someone else to, like, want this bod. So join the Patreon.
Patreon.com/theyliketowatch. And later on this episode, we have executive producer of The Jury Murder Trial, Ed Kelly. I was struggling to find the right thing for us to watch together this week. And in desperation, I said to you, it's been a while since we watched something shitty and then just ripped it apart. And I noticed there's a new Guy Ritchie thing on Netflix. Shall we do that? And you grudgingly went along with it. But then things took a turn and I quite enjoyed it. And I don't know myself. It's making me fundamentally question who I am. It's like I've got into cockfighting, which is something you might see in a Guy Ritchie film. I don't know myself anymore. And also, I don't quite know why I have such a hatred for Guy Ritchie. And now I've got my class chip on my shoulder.
I didn't know until I started Googling him after watching The Gentleman that he was posh. I thought he was like a working class boy.
And I think that is a big part of it. So The Gentleman then, I'm going to try and explain it. A rich old duke dies. But then, plot twist, at the reading of his will, he hasn't left his enormous estate to his hedonistic firstborn prodigal son. He has left it to his sensible ex-military UN peacekeeper secondborn son. But plot twist again, the hedonistic one is £8 million in gambling debts to gangsters who are about to kill him. So he needs the brother to sell the house to pay the debt. But plot twist again, when the good brother goes to do this, he discovers that he can't because his dead dad has been renting out part of the estate to drug dealers who have a vast underground cannabis farm. So if he doesn't raise the money by selling the house, the gangsters will kill his brother. But if he does sell the house, then the drug dealers will come after him.
Now, I have to say, to the credit of the show, I think all of this is laid out, not like believably, but entertainingly and likably.
And entertainingly is the word, because even though it has some of the things you would expect from Guy Ritchie, there is something occasionally funny, but definitely addictive about it.
It was incredibly watchable. Something about it like reminded me of Knives Out.
Yes, good as Knives Out. I have the same thought, yes.
But if you loved that first Knives Out, there's something about the atmospheres that feel similar.
These two brothers then, there's the wild one and there's the mild one. Do you have a preference?
Yeah, the mild.
This is a guy called Theo James, which isn't necessarily a name you get to straight away, but you've seen him, and specifically you've seen him in White Lotus season 2.
Yes, so you remember in White Lotus season 2, there were those two couples, and one was Will Sharp and Aubrey Plaza, and then there was the other one, which was like douchebag finance guy. Theo James played the finance guy, and he is so wonderful to watch.
Are you talking about his face here?
It's, you know, with a song, what is lyrics and what is melody? Like, I don't know.
And the wild brother is Daniel Ings, who's been in a load of stuff, but I think I know him best for being Billy Piper's husband in I Hate Susie and I Hate Susie Too.
And what a job he does. Wow. It's fun to watch him do that part.
But you don't do well with a wild hedonistic character generally.
No, but I feel a certain compassion because I see a little of myself in him.
I'm surprised because we see him quite consistently vaping some kind of like cigar vape. And you're very disgusted by this.
The aroma of vapes to me is one of the vilest things. I would rather someone blows a cigarette out directly in my face, like the worst air freshener you've ever smelled in the most disgusting bathroom does not smell as bad to me as like people with vapes that have flavors to them. So when I have to inhale your vape on a busy London street, I'm disgusted, but I respect your right to do it. Don't do it indoors when I have to fucking smell your bullshit.
How do you feel about doing a Zoom call with someone who's vaping?
I hate it. Can you remember the last time you were doing a work call and someone was just smoking a cigarette? Like, what are you doing? It feels like maybe like, you know what I want to do? I got a callus on my foot that I'd like to get at right now. Do you mind if I get, because I have flexible legs, I could get my foot up. Look, I could get my foot up, but this is a private, this is for me and you when we're on the sofa alone. It's not for a Zoom call.
We should talk about some of the other cast members in this show.
Yes.
Gus Fring from Breaking Bad.
Yes, playing a meth dealer again. So fun to see him again, but not the most original use of his talents.
Ray Winstone is in it, unsurprisingly. Peter Serafinovich crops up in episode 1.
Oh, I have nothing interesting to say except what an overwhelming talent he is.
Yeah.
It's such a sexual show because the two brothers are so fucking hot. Peter Serafinowicz as a person, as a talent, is so hot. And who plays the groundskeeper?
Vinnie Jones.
Oh.
I think Vinnie Jones might be my single biggest problem with Guy Ritchie.
Oh, no.
I think he is an awful man.
Why?
Or certainly he has an awful past. He has been a horrible, violent man. He was a footballer. Oh, no. And he was always biting people.
Oh, no.
And I don't just mean on the football field, where, of course, you shouldn't be biting people anyway. I mean, he bit a journalist's nose in a bar brawl. He bit a neighbour in the head and then repeatedly stamped on him. He was on a plane one time and a guy asked him to stop harassing a woman and he slammed his head into a window. So this was all stuff that was known about Vinnie Jones.
Can I just say real fast, the character is so restrained. That is what I like about the character, the restraint.
I want to say, this is all stuff that was known about Vinnie Jones. Mm-hmm. And then Guy Ritchie feels like being a tourist in a violent world and then starts casting him in films and makes him a star. I mean, when it suits me, I can separate the art from the artist. Yeah, look, I know Jerry Seinfeld dated a 17-year-old when he was nearly 40, but different times. But there is something about Vinnie Jones that sits very uncomfortably with me.
Uh-huh.
Given that the primary location of this show is a stately home, how would you do with staff? Because we have a cleaner come in once a week, and I wouldn't say you have the smoothest of interactions all the time.
We do have. She and I have a very, very good and very easy dynamic, and that is the truth of it.
She was doing the washing up at the sink. You wanted to get yourself some food, cut yourself some bread or whatever it was, and the kitchen knife was on a draining rack above the sink. So you had to reach over her to get this big knife. And because that felt a bit uncomfortable or awkward or whatever it was to you, as you were retrieving it, you did the psycho with the knife at her. Only she just looked really disturbed by it.
It felt like she didn't know the reference.
And then you said, psycho. and complete blank face.
No.
But then 10 minutes later, you're back with your phone showing her the scene from Psycho.
Is that what happened?
Yes.
Are you making that up?
No.
I have no memory of that.
No, because
happening.
You've repressed it because it was so uncomfortable
well,
for everyone
just to make
involved.
The point, this is the exception, not the rule.
And you wouldn't make her call you your grace if it was a stately home and not a terraced house.
Maybe just on my birthday.
Listen, here's what I want to say about it. If you don't watch it, you're not really missing a cultural moment.
That's fair.
It is simultaneously what you would expect a Guy Ritchie thing to be, but is also surprisingly enjoyable. But if you go to watch it thinking the UK's podcasting sweethearts say this is good, you might come away a bit disappointed.
If there's just a little hole in your life and you just want fun and a bit ridiculous, but still with a decent sense of humor.
Some violence happening in slow motion to an opera soundtrack.
Okay, calm the fuck down. It's very fun and weirdly, in its own way, light despite the violence. Get into it.
Have you seen The Gentlemen? Is there something weird going on with us this week that we enjoyed it? I'll tell you what I've read, actually. I've read mediocre reviews from British press and glowing reviews from Americans.
Oh, that's interesting.
So I think we have all this baggage. It's not just me.
Okay.
We as a country have all this baggage about Guy Ritchie.
Got it.
But there's all this nuance within class that is invisible to a non-British person that can really rub us the wrong way.
Well, aren't you amazing?
Let us know what you think. The email address is
fuckoff@firecrotchandnormcore.com.
And coming up next, he is the executive producer and the creative director of the company behind The Jury Murder Trial on Channel 4. It is
Tall Drink of Water, Ed Kelly.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I've spoken to two separate people very high up at the Old Bailey, and they are all talking about this show. Are you aware of this?
Yeah, the legal community are, I'm sure a lot of them are supportive, but quite a lot of them are, let's say, defensive about the show. Even yesterday, there was a piece in The Times which was basically saying, you know, it's riddled with these inaccuracies, but it's good telly. Don't judge juries on this show was their line, really. And actually, there's a couple of things I have to say. I would love to set the record straight because I do slightly feel like they're avoiding the elephant in the room, which is that juries are kind of a lottery.
Yes.
You know, and yeah, they could go either way.
What's an accusation that they've made that you think is unfair?
They say that juries don't, during the recesses whilst the trial is going on, they say that the jury don't go away and discuss the case. And they're instructed not to discuss the case until they've heard all the evidence. That's factually just not true.
Right.
I can prove it in our transcript that they are directed to discuss the case only when they're together, which of course they were. They're all in the same room. And we spoke to lots of jurors. You know, we spent 2.5 years researching this before we even went into production, right? We spoke to a lot of jurors, and some juries and some courts, in between the recess, they go back out to a public area, in which case they probably don't discuss the case. But in many, they do actually go to the deliberation room. 12 people have just heard some heavy evidence. They're together. What are they going to talk about?
Yeah.
And we've had it on good authority. Of course, they do talk about the case.
Why do you think they're saying otherwise?
I don't know why. And I find it a bit depressing, if I'm really honest, because I do feel like, genuinely, this is not an anti-jury show. This is an anti-unnecessary secrecy and mystery show.
Yeah,
okay? Just trying to sort of start a conversation about,
yes,
can it be, this is not a binary choice, have juries, not have juries. There are things that could be done to improve juries. And actually, you sort of think, well, surely as a barrister, the little bit of you that went into this profession because you cared about justice, cared about doing the right thing. And what I'm getting from some of these people is, actually, leave us alone, stay out of our world. We're quite happy it being completely mysterious and secretive.
Was that the light bulb moment for you? Was it thinking part of the criminal justice system happens behind closed doors?
So the story behind it was actually, it was 2020, lockdown, Black Lives Matter protests sweeping the world. And we were having conversations about unconscious bias, personal biases. Can you avoid bias? What's the difference between bias and life experience? Mm. And of course, lovely talking point, but you know, we're not writing a Guardian article. We've got to make a bit of telly out of it. Mm. How do you do it? Where's it going to be expressed? And of course, ping, inside a jury room. And then I thought, well, we've got to do it for a real case. So I got on the phone straight away to a lawyer and asked, is there any way we can do this legally? It sounds terrifying and dangerous and full of libel risks and things. Anyway, there was a way of doing it. And we knew once it was possible, we were onto something really exciting.
We felt personally the one who had the lightning bolt in his beard.
Ricky! Yeah.
We felt that the lightning bolt in the beard said, I shouldn't be allowed on a jury and I should be accused. Can you talk me through the casting process of a man with a lightning bolt in his beard?
Believe it or not, he is kind of a gentle giant. He really is. So real jury selection is a dart thrown into the electoral roll, basically. But it's not quite like that as well, because what happens is anyone who's a full-time carer, full-time mum, dad, or, you know, looking after someone else, or has got a really busy job, or even just a full-time job, can basically get it deferred and then eventually excused. So what happens is you have this huge bias towards very young and very old. Mm. And that creates a dynamic in the room in and of itself.
Oh my God.
So it's not this sort of evenly split thing, okay, even in reality. Okay, that's the first thing to say.
How are people not fixing that issue? That's crazy.
It is crazy. It is crazy. But how do you get around? You know what they say.
But
like in Denmark, for example, they'll hire you for a year, and you get paid a pretty decent wage. So people actually quite want to do it, and you get trained in how to discuss cases, trained in how to kind of check your own and other people's biases, and sort of and little bits of basic law to help make sure you understand the law. And then you basically plow through as many cases as you can in a year. And because you're trained at it, actually, they get through them quite quick. And they reckon it's probably actually cheaper than our system, even though our jurors are paid like 65 quid a day, which obviously is tough to survive on.
Yeah.
So
did you look into legal systems in other countries then?
Of course. But you look at kind of the top 15, and at least 9 of them are countries that don't have juries. And then in some places, I mean, the most extreme, and I find this extraordinary, in Holland, get this, they don't have juries at all, but they don't even have trials. What they do is they get the defense and the prosecution to submit all of their evidence on paper or on video, and they just plonk it in front of 3 judges who plow through the whole lot. No one performs anything, and then they just make a decision.
That's interesting.
Those systems are more about the judge trying to just find the truth. Mm. And in a sense, the police evidence is the prosecution evidence. And then talking to the families and talking to defence families and witnesses and stuff might then end up being more the defence evidence. So they don't sort of split defence and prosecution in quite the way that we do. And our coroner's courts work the same way, actually. So in coroner's courts, take the Hillsborough inquest, right? The judge, and they have juries in that, lay juries, who sit alone in a room without a judge to make the decision. But they weren't just asked, were Sheffield police guilty or not guilty? It's not a binary question. They were given 22 questions to answer about what happened that day. Did they overcrowd? Was X responsible or was Y responsible? Did the police not react quickly enough? Mm. You have to say why someone is guilty or not guilty. And I think there's a compelling case for that. When you consider that, like, Ministry of Justice's own figures say that 70% of jurors cannot recall the key legal directions of the case.
From watching these jurors, there's all this other stuff like likability.
Totally.
Or, you know, underlying
They said
biases.
Themselves, are we judging the character or the act? And it's like, You absolutely are judging the act. It is about a crime. Yes. Was this murder or not? The whole loss of control thing is super confusing.
Yes.
Because actually it's a double negative. It's not actually would a reasonable person have done the same thing in the same circumstances? Uh-huh. Because you're innocent until proven guilty, it's might a reasonable person have done the same thing. And therefore, you are only guilty of murder if you can prove that a reasonable person might not have done the same thing. So, you know, you're doing kind of backflips in your head trying to work it all out, right?
A might is such an intangible word.
It is, it is. Yeah. Exactly. And then that question itself, it's such a sort of tiny question upon which the whole thing sort of balances.
How did you decide when you were sort of still in the, or like the process of beginning this show, what kind of case you were looking for?
So there's the sort of social experiment answer is that we did some research where we looked at murder and manslaughter statistics. This was back in 21 and the last available statistics were like 2018 or something. Anyway, we found that if the victim of a killing was a woman, then the perpetrator of the killing was 24% less likely to get convicted than if the victim was a man. Now, that obviously raises huge questions about, well, what's happening in the jury rooms and what's happening with those cases? And most women are killed in domestic situations. So we were like, okay, so let's do a domestic homicide or femicide case. The other answer, of course, is we are making TV. We wanted a case that was super relatable. Virtually everybody has got experience of a long-term relationship or knows someone who has. Virtually all of us have been in highly dysfunctional relationships. We know how crazy it can get. We know how crazy it can get in good relationships, let alone dysfunctional ones.
I was shocked by the number of men and women on those juries who looked normal and were riddled with so much misogyny and intrigue and this idea that, like, she did have three kids by three different men, and so maybe she did deserve to die. You know, I couldn't believe how much sexism there was.
No, I mean, nor could we. And I think actually we were incredibly fair in the edit. We could have been a lot more vicious, and we weren't. We genuinely kind of reined it back a little bit just to kind of make the point. But, you know, those people, like you say, absolutely ordinary people. And you know, maybe we'd be saying the same sort of stuff because you're forced to go. What the crime does is it forces you to go to a very dark place. This isn't like nice dinner party chat, all right? This is somebody whose life is on the line and they're claiming that they lost control. And is that really, actually, when you think about it, it is perhaps possible for somebody to lose control. So therefore, you have to go to a place and think about what would have driven someone, what would be the, in the legal speak, the qualifying triggers to drive someone to lose control.
Before you sort of understand what you're in for, you're getting to know a show. And it wasn't clear to me until a ways into the show that they knew that they weren't at a real murder trial.
Look, they didn't know anything about the crime before it started. So all we told them was that it was a serious crime. What we did say to them, just remember, this is a genuine experiment. We did ask them to take it seriously. And I said, just remember that the real families involved will either watching or having friends watching. And you don't want to do anything. You don't want to be that person who's kind of just messing around or whatever, you know. If I were you, I'd take it quite seriously. But we had to say that once. Mm. Once only.
That's interesting. Can you, I'd like to circle back, as they say, what is the difference between bias and life experience?
Oh, man.
Can you tell me? I've never heard that expressed that way.
And a jury, the reason juries are brilliant compared maybe with a judge is that they bring that thorny life experience in a way that, you know, all the things that we're going, oh, they're saying such sort of awful comments. But in a way, they're sort of also engaging with the idea that maybe you could lose control and strangle someone. Maybe. It's a dark, weird place. I'm not saying you can or can't. I'm just saying they're prepared to at least discuss it. And so that sort of real lived experience actually could be helpful in a way that if it was just kind of judges or whatever, they might be a bit more, no, I'm, you know, they're very reserved.
I think you should pitch.
Okay, I've got some ideas.
You tell me. He's diversifying his portfolio, so you see if there's anything that
I scribbled these down in the half hour before you came this morning. Do any of these pass the Ed Kelly test? Would you take any of them to a channel? First one. Is your air fryer trying to kill you?
So air fryers, I noticed, right? The overnights on this show were good, but, you know, what's really stellar is all the catch-up. We actually got beaten, I think EP2 got beaten by an air fryer doc on Channel 5.
Yeah, Channel 5 have pivoted to an all-air fryer, all-the-time format.
So anything with air fryers is a brilliant idea. It doesn't matter what it is.
Okay. How to credit check your friends. Like, how are they affording to live in that house? Ooh. What kind of debt are they running?
Yeah, what's the truth?
I want a show that gets at the financial truth of everyone you know.
How much are the parents bankrolling? Like?
Yeah. Parents, exactly. Husband, wife, like, how did you make that happen for yourself?
Yeah, and then you have to try and keep the friendship afterwards when they've found out.
I don't know. I don't even know what I want. I just wish I could really... Yeah. Just wish everyone would have to answer my money question.
Something it's a bit woolly. Something like the Nuremberg trials, but it's us as a nation being held responsible for enabling James Corden.
Ooh, yeah. our terrible exports.
The hunt for a life coach with an enviable life.
That's actually brilliant.
Any life coaches who you want to be?
Yeah, no, exactly. Never. Oh yeah. God, those who can. Those who can't become life coach, that's awful, isn't it?
No, but it's real. We'll let you go now soon, Ed. But
I didn't answer one of your questions, actually, which I'm feeling a bit bad about, the casting one.
So
I sort of skipped around it. I wasn't being a politician. What we did was we blitzed social and local media, you know, radio stations, newspapers, that sort of thing. And we had a really big response because, you know, it's quite an appealing thing to want to be on a jury. We then interviewed... The casting team are brilliant. They literally just like spend all day. They get on the phone. They get to know people, and they basically kind of made sure that we had a pool of people who fully understood they had to commit 2 weeks, could afford it, was realistic, etc. So that pool sort of shrunk it down. We got to know these people, and a lot of people are saying, "Oh, you must have gone looking for people who've been in abusive relationships or had been the instigator in dysfunctional relationships." The truth is, we didn't have to look. It is depressingly common that we at no point did we do a casting call. Have you been in a difficult relationship? At no point did that happen. Our sort of parameters, I suppose, was there was a bit of research that said that typical juries often have one or two dominant characters, then there's five or six that are swearable, and then there's some three or four that say nothing. And so one of my big briefs was, they were sort of, in a way, the hardest. It was like, I want really uninteresting people. I want people who don't care about this experiment, people who don't want to do it, people who don't want to be there, so that it really feels like a cross-section. We cast the 24 people. All right. And there were a few spares just in case someone got ill or whatever. But then we randomly, and I've actually got a video of shuffling cards and dealing them out. We randomly split them into two piles, two juries.
Oh, that's interesting, because I assume there was like a little bit of sort of casting manipulation.
We talked about it on the channel extensively, but literally, I mean, it was terrifying. It was actually the night before filming started. Up in a little room in the top of the courthouse, we are randomly splitting these people out.
I mean, credit to the channel for not getting nervous about that stuff in this day and age. You know, it's Channel 4, 1986. You think, okay, maybe they'll do it with absolute purity. But these days, and with the commercial pressures they're under.
And actually, credit to them for going for it, because Channel 4's been going through a really, really tough time. You know, it's public knowledge that they've been making 18% of the workforce redundant. So to make this show, they had to actually cancel some of their long-running shows. And I feel incredibly lucky and fortunate that we've been able to reward that with a hit. But if we hadn't, it would have been pretty bleak and depressing, to be honest.
What are you watching at the moment?
What am I watching at the moment? We watch with our kids, so 15-year-old boy, 13-year-old boy.
You've managed to get teenagers to watch broadcast television and not TikTok.
Actually, what they would watch, if they had a choice, they'd watch Love Island sort of end-to-end, which, you know, I don't love. I watch a lot of factual, popular factual stuff, because not just because of my profession, I genuinely love it. I think there's something special about real people. I'm a total sucker for Traitors, Squid Game. That's a really impressive bit of telly, because Abs gets absolutely sick of watching factual stuff after a while. So we were enjoying One Day, but everyone's watched One Day, right? So it's
that's
not particularly
fine, that's
original.
Fine, but that's, you did One Day.
Yeah.
With your kids or without?
With the older one. The younger one got a bit bored, but I was welling up in tears at One Day. It was really good. Yeah, it was really, really good.
We didn't cry. We're big criers, and we didn't cry at one day.
Oh, it almost felt like you're not going to make me cry. It was trying too hard to make me cry.
Really? Oh, yeah. God, I'm such a sucker then. Damn.
No. We're the exception. You've done the norm. We've had the strange response, I think.
Ed Kelly, I think it probably only reflects well on our marriage that you sit here talking about how attractive you found him.
So tall. Take me to the inbox, to the inbox, take me to the inbox. Here I am in the inbox, 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 inbox. Six sides on my box. How many sides are on a box? Six.
Are you trapped inside of it like Marcel Marceau?
It started, and then I started picturing out of nowhere Magritte. I don't know why. And then I was like very 3D, and then it was M.C. Escher, and then it was in the box. As you are now. Our first email comes from Erwin. Am I saying your name correctly, Erwin? I hope I am. Hi, FC and NC, longtime listener, first-time emailer. That is just one of my favorite sentences ever to read. I'm a former barrister and can help alleviate your bewilderment over barristers' wigs. Barristers have been wearing wigs as part of their court dress since the 1600s. They were originally status symbols, although over time they were seen as a way of, one, marking the solemnity of the courtroom, and two, differentiating between the advocates and their clients.
Other countries don't seem to have a problem. You can generally differentiate.
This doesn't need an opinion from you.
Here's what I want to know.
Fine.
If you were to see a lawyer and a defendant having a little chat outside a courtroom, so the wigs aren't on, the robes aren't on, how many times out of 10 do you think you would be able to identify the defendant versus the...
Now, 10 out of 10, but we're talking about 1600s. Mm-hmm. What you need to really be paying attention to is not that, but like how well written this email is. She just gave us a bunch of history. But not too much. And now we're on to the next point she needs to make. I'm inclined to agree with FC. The fact that we still have them in 2024 is pretty ridiculous. And actually, in most areas of law, they are no longer worn. I used to practice employment, housing, and family law and almost never needed to wear my wig and gown. It's pretty much just the criminal bar who, for some reason, want to maintain the strange horsehair throwback. The wigs are pretty itchy. And mine, a secondhand wig gifted to me when I was starting out by a retiring chain-smoking barrister, really smells of stale cigarettes. That's amazing. No amount of Febrezing has got rid of the smell. But there's a story, and you get, someone who's leaving gives you their wig. Okay.
I don't want the story of an item to be told via its smell.
I didn't know that, like, a smoky smell could stay in a wig for that long. That's really vile, but so interesting. NC asked if the wigs are given to barristers when they are called to the bar. They are not.
Uh-huh.
In fact, a wig will set you back around £600.
Uh-huh.
If you want a fancy, quote unquote, frizz top wig, that will set you back $2,500. Fascinating. You'll need to purchase your wig from the legal equivalent of a school uniform shop, Eden Ravenscroft on Chancery Lane. If you want to keep your wig protected from damage when carting it down to Woolwich Crown Court, you can also buy special quote-unquote wig tins.
Wow.
These cost upward of £200, so I elected to keep mine in a Tupperware. Because so many non-criminal barristers only have to wear their wig on rare occasions, and because they are so expensive, I can confirm that wig sharing in chambers is pretty common.
I wonder if there's a knits problem.
Yeah, adults don't get knits the same way kids do, though, do they? Or is it kids and barristers? Wouldn't that be a plot twist? As to how to keep your wig clean, as disgusting as it sounds, that's not really the dumb thing. There is a long-standing perception amongst barristers that your wig should not be pristine and white because no one wants to look like the new kid on the block when standing in front of a judge or jury. I've heard rumors of barristers deliberately knocking their wig about a bit, kicking it in the dirt, or even taking tea bags to it.
Like when you get a new pair of trainers when you're a kid and you don't want them to look too spiffy.
Like they're asking for it or something. This gives the appearance of age. Wig sellers threaten Thresher and Glennie advise not trying to clean your wig more than every 25 to 30 years. Love to you both, Erwin. Erwin, one of my favorite emails of all time.
Yes.
That was so fascinating. It was just a pleasure. Thank you for taking the time.
This comes from Chris Hoskins, who says, I'm really enjoying True Detective Night Country, but something is really, really bothering me. Why did none of them zip their coats up, especially when it's so cold and there's a blizzard? Are there any other clothing issues you've noticed in your past viewings that really bothered you? Regards, Chris Hoskins. Let me tell you something.
Gone.
I have got an enormous problem with the fact that people have always got shoes on indoors on television.
Yes, but you're Mr. Shoes Off.
Your parents do it.
Yes, but my parents would never ask someone to take their shoes off.
No, it's what people say. People come in through your front door. They say, should I take my shoes off? And you can say, oh, if you don't mind. That's all I ever do.
Yeah, but I don't think my parents would say, if you don't mind. I think of you as being very, very different in your shoe-off mentality than either of my parents.
I don't think I've ever seen a full episode of Friends, but I have happened across it. And my first thought is, why have these people got their shoes on?
Yes, but that's like not the most unrealistic part of that show. This is a good question, though. Clothing that annoys you.
Or doesn't ring true in some way.
Chris, thank you. I'm going to think aunt and also ask other listeners to do the same. This last email comes from Mike Wharton, who writes, Dear FNN, after listening to you talk about the jury murder trial, I wanted to point you toward Eyewitness, a program from 2011 that left a lasting impression on me. 10 people were recruited to take part in what they thought were some standard psychometric tests for a TV program. But during the lunch break, they are secretly filmed as they witness what they believe to be a real crime, a knife attack in a Manchester pub. The whole pub has been taken over by the program, however, and everyone else in there was an actor. They had real paramedics and police turn up, who were obviously party to it, but didn't tell the 10 people it was fake until 2 hours afterward. The participants were then interviewed by the police as if it was still a real incident, and the police had no prior knowledge of what had happened, and so interviewed the 10 people as if they were investigating a real crime. The participants' memories are radically different to each other's and to what really happened, and the police have to decide who's a reliable witness and who isn't and what had occurred. It was a fascinating and concerning insight into witnesses and memory recall, especially if the recall of those witnesses may be used to decide the innocence or guilt of someone in court, and fits in with your discussion of how juries decide on who is telling the truth in court. It isn't on iPlayer anymore, but it is available on YouTube.
Now, that's so interesting, isn't it? It feels ethically questionable a little bit. Feels like a very extreme version of a candid camera.
Thank you, Mike. This looks fascinating.
That email address again is?
Fuck off. Guys, no, I'm not even going to tell you the email address. You know it. Please write in. That's a service you can do for me. I get a dopamine hit. I want my dopamine. Write to me. Patreon me.
Don't use Patreon as a verb.
Patreon me. Here's what you got to do. You're going to do one of these things this week. Every fucking one of you who listens to this podcast is going to do one of these things this week. I don't care what it is, but you have four to choose from. One, Patreon me. That's my number one choice. Two, come to my show on the 17th of March at 4 p.m. at the Bill Murray Comedy Club in Islington. Three, tell a friend about us. Four, email me.
Oh, and our email address is fuckoff@vayogajandromgore.com.
This week, Ed Kelly liked to watch Squid Game and One Day, both on Netflix. I watched The Completely Made-Up Adventures of Dick Turpin on Apple TV+. Sarah watched All the Beauty and the Bloodshed on BBC iPlayer. And we watched The Gentleman on Netflix.
And it was very fun. What if I had a long mustache? One of those cartoonish mustaches. I have to stay very on top of my facial hair so that you don't have a bearded wife, you know. That's another thing I do that goes unappreciated. Women, what is your invisible work? I have so much invisible work in my marriage, you can't believe it. One of them, keeping on top of my facial hair. I'm not shaming you if you don't stay on top of your facial hair. You let your beard do what it wants to do. But I keep my little whiskers trim on my chin and on my upper lip. It's blonde, but in the wrong light, very visible. And the light is coming. Have you noticed that the light is coming? The light is coming. Daylight savings is coming. Are we gaining our energy? Are we gaining our warmth? Will I see you on Sunday? Will we see you next week? I think we will.
This is an accent. Is this an accent?
No, there's no accent. It's on the right side of any possible line. Goodbye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.